The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Welcome to The Fandom Files, a Sci-Fi Wire podcast about people who really, really love stuff. I'm Jordan Zachrin, the features editor at Sci-Fi Wire, and I'm joined today by my good pal and guest co-host, Caitlin Bush, who is the associate features editor at Sci-Fi Wire. Caitlin, for our hardcore fans, know that she's called in before during the show about fictional deaths that made us cry in real life. Now she's in studio, and the next step she will be replacing me. Caitlin, how's it going?
Going good. Hey, Jordan. Happy to be here on this beautiful day and looking forward to replacing Emily as well as I can and
yes.
Not failing.
Well, luckily we have an awesome guest, so even if we both suck, it'll be fine. We're going to
pressure on.
Well, we're both going to suck, so it's not that much pressure.
Okay, good.
There you go. You just heard his voice. Drew Pearce is a screenwriter. He wrote Iron Man 3, among other movies, and now he's a writer-director. He's the visionary behind the probably way too accurate for comfort portrait of the future, near future Hotel Artemis. Drew, thanks so much for coming and hanging out.
Oh, thank you for having me.
How's it going?
Good. Really good.
Yeah?
You know, it's interesting being a writer-director because I thought, you know, with something like Iron Man, you're front and center and you know, occasionally people may disagree with, for example, what you might do with a villain. But it's a whole different thing being the writer and director. Your head is a long way above the parapet, and you're out there hustling. I'm selling.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Are you buying? Because I'm selling.
I'm all in. I saw the movie, and we both saw it, so we both loved it. So
fantastic!
We bought.
Well, that's a very good. Well, I don't need to sell anymore then.
Yeah,
I'll just relax.
Done. Yeah,
yeah.
Certainly people have strong opinions about Marvel movies. So
yes, they do. I've spotted that. I know. Weird, so
right?
Weird.
You're way better at pitching movies, obviously, than I am.
It
worked.
It's your job.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Some days you're right. That's absolutely right.
So what is it about for our listeners?
Well, Hotel Artemis is actually like a very simple story. It's set in near future Los Angeles, and it's about a secret hospital for criminals run by Jodie Foster's character, the nurse. And the movie is about what happens one night when the wrong group of people are trapped in there by some riots that are taking over Los Angeles.
All right, over water.
Yes, the water riots. Yeah. That didn't take an awful lot of... It is weird because I keep talking to people and they talk about it as a dystopian movie. And in my head, I was never going for dystopia. I was just like, I was just... will be like in 10 years.
Yeah.
Like there's no kind of extrapolation beyond common sense as far as I'm concerned.
There's optimism here that it is 10 years from now in 2028.
Maybe that, but by the way, that is the weird thing about writing essentially speculative fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because for the first few drafts, the mob boss that's in the movie that in the real version is played by Jeff Goldblum and is a kind of archetypally Angelino character.
Sure.
For the first few drafts, he was a Russian mob boss. Mm. And that was 3.5 years ago. And it quickly became apparent that if I'm setting something 10 years in the future and the Russians are the bad guys, then I already got caught up with that.
Yes.
Like, I need to try harder.
Right.
And there's a bunch of stuff like that. I mean, though sometimes it can go the other direction as well, because it rained for like 10 days in LA, everyone's now pretending like there isn't a water problem in California. So it's
right.
Like, there won't be any water riots.
Well, you could have set this in Detroit and that would happen like next year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Truly. Well, and weirdly, I wrote a movie about Flint.
Did you?
Based on like a true story from 1990. And I went and lived in Flint for like 3 or 4 weeks. And the day I got back, there was like, small problem with the water in Flint. And I had been drinking it every day.
Oof.
For 4 weeks. But yeah, no, I mean, water is genuinely like a commodity going forwards. Like there are underground water silos around the world that are actually becoming as valuable as like gold mines.
Wow.
How's that for a fact?
Damn, I didn't know that.
That's one of the problems in the movie is that water has been privatized.
Absolutely, yeah. And recently privatized, like 3 days before the film. and Los Angeles is in uproar about it. But it's, you know, there's kind of, there's a little theme in there should someone wish to go looking for it, which is, you know, this is about a hospital where the people inside it have paid to be there and feel protected from the outside world. And throughout the movie, there's this sense of a kind of demonized horde that they're hiding from. But ultimately, the problem is actually in there with them rather than in this outside faceless problem.
Yeah, it's like bad guys and badder guys.
Yeah, totally. And also the idea that, like, the thing we think is the enemy may not be the real problem.
Yeah, I was definitely rooting for everyone on the outside.
Yeah, yeah, well, by the way, they literally are. In the end, they're kind of like... they're kind of like the Greek chorus. They're like an opera in the end.
The thing is, it's really hard.
Weird pitch for the movie, but
it's really hard to root against Jodie Foster and Sterling K. Brown and Brian Henry Terry. Like, it's so hard to root against them.
No, but I mean, and that's actually like it's one of the reasons that I made it as an indie movie is that I didn't want it to have like a standard, you know, three act structure. So it's really, it's like two halves, this film. And the first half, my job is to make you fall in love with every single one of these characters, even the most repulsive. And the second half of the movie is about me killing some of them and you not knowing who's going to die and you on being on the edge of your seat in case your favorite is the one that goes.
Who is your favorite? Not necessarily to kill, but your favorite character.
Oh, man. Do you know what? In all of the stuff that I've been doing over the last couple of weeks, no one's asked me who my favorite character is.
There's so many good characters.
I know, and I think that's probably the thing. I should probably say that my favorite character is the fourth bank robber who's called P22 and is played by Father John Misty. There you go. That's my favorite character.
I did not catch that.
I was amazed by, like, every time, I guess I kind of knew the cast going in since I read the press notes, but every time someone else popped up, I was like, oh, shit. Like that Quinto paps up and I was like, oh my God.
It's amazing. Yeah. And, you know, and I really wanted to play with that as well. I mean, you don't want literally everyone to be a kind of like turns to camera. Yeah. Oh, which is what I felt like Cold Mountain did. Mm-hmm. I felt like you met every character like on their back and then they slowly turned and looked over their shoulder. So I didn't want it like that, but I do think it's really important to like give every character an entrance to and, you know, with someone like with Zach's character in the movie, I stayed just on his lips for the first minute and a half of seeing him. Obviously, you know, if you've seen the trailer, you know that, like, I pump the Jeff Goldblum entrance into the movie for all it's worth.
Of course. You know? How do you not?
But even Jodie playing the nurse, she's obviously playing a character in the film that is actually 12 years older than she really is.
Oh,
so
yeah.
She's got subtle, you know, aging makeup on. And weirdly, like the movie used to start, or her section of the movie used to start with like a wide shot and she would wake up in bed and it's this beautiful shot. And actually what I discovered when I was making it is it takes people some time to get used to someone with like old people makeup on.
Mm.
So actually we start in a shot that we can then like live in for 15 seconds while people kind of find their sea legs with what she looks like. So it's weird. Like whatever you plan, there's often something that's either better or necessary.
Well, it's also like Jodie Foster hasn't done a ton of late.
No.
And so then I'm like, I don't think she's that old. But yeah, that's, I was kind of surprised. Like, yeah.
I had that exact moment.
Yeah,
I was
absolutely.
Like,
and by the way, that's great. And I think she knows that as well. I think she likes that that people don't really know how she looks at the moment.
Yeah.
And I actually, oddly, I think it does help us as well because, you know, if it's someone that you see every day in a magazine and then they're in old people makeup, you're like, you know, it takes you a little bit longer to kind of buy into the fiction of it.
Yeah.
But with Jodie, and it's very subtle as well.
Like, sure.
I was very against using any like kind of prosthetics.
It wasn't like Benjamin Button or anything.
No. Well, and also like, you know, Benjamin Button's like craft services probably cost more than our whole movie. So so I didn't quite have the resources to try and age her digitally, you know.
You,
and I'm glad.
Yeah, I think it works really well.
Yeah.
You, this movie, like, you've carried it around in your head for a long time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, years and years.
Sure.
Where was the initial idea, and then why now?
I'd love to pretend that I have any control over my career or even my life.
So do I. I like to pretend that.
But it's, I'm going to break it to you. It's bullshit. yeah, I know. Sorry. I'm sorry to be that guy. and so, you know, this was like a germ of an idea I had actually when I was making Iron Man 3. And the way my ideas tend to work is that they kind of coalesce with other stuff. Like, you know, even though it's set in a near future Los Angeles and it's a relatively high concept, I also always thought about it as this story about this little old lady who was kind of caring for her lost boys in some way to atone for this thing she thinks she caused in the past. And so all those things get stuck together. But I can't tell you that, like, I knew this was the one because I spec'd three whole other scripts in the last 8 years to be my directorial debut. And they, none of them quite made it over the line. The last one nearly did, and it was at Fox. And but it finally, it needed one of three Chris's to say yes, and none of the Chris's were available. So no movie. But this one, there was something in the characters, like the vibrancy of them, maybe, that meant that a lot of brilliant actors were attracted to it. And, you know, it's a movie I was able to do on a budget and still make it look as big as I possibly could.
Yeah, I mean, it's set in pretty much one place.
That's right. Yeah, it's a bubble episode.
Yeah,
you know, it's and that's a very fine tradition that, you know, there's clearly the lineage back to John Carpenter, who is the master of bubbles. You know, with original Precinct 13 and with with The Thing. They're a great way of telling a short form story. And it's one of the reasons that, like, I miss, you know, movies that aren't just a $5 million horror movie or a $200 million tentpole, is I miss little stories told big, you know? Like, the movies I loved when I was growing up were often like the first Terminator. That's just a story about three people in downtown LA across one night, essentially.
Yeah.
But it's a keyhole to a giant universe that I saw enough of in the Terminator. I still think it's Skynet stuff, and more importantly, people talking about Skynet was more exciting than as we eventually got to see more and more of that actual world.
Yeah. I love Genesis, though.
I will respectfully take myself out of that part of the conversation.
You know, well, what's interesting is, like you said, there's so few movies that kind of A, stand alone, and B, aren't either $5 million or $200 million movies. You've worked in big franchises where you learn more and more and more.
Yeah.
And so you are inventing here the entire world.
Yeah, right. But that's the interesting thing, is because we now think of, you know, and the term is now cinematic universe, we think of that as being a thing where you see the whole universe. And I love when I just hear little snippets of it and I get to join it up for myself. And that's, you know, that's something like, to go one level geekier in the deep cuts. That's why, like, Repo Man is one of my favorite movies of all time, because nobody explains shit to you in Repo Man. Like, I don't know. What is in the trunk? Does it matter?
Right.
I think we've gotten used to, as an audience, and even like as a sophisticated, like, geek connoisseur audience, we've gotten used to everything being explained and like being able to see everything. And I like leaving some of that out. I like leaving that to the imagination a little bit. And also, when you only have $14 million, like, you can't show it. So you better do it properly.
Well, it's like prequels. We learn stories you don't need.
Honestly, don't.
Yeah.
I mean, like, but that's the weird thing, is like, what can make a character powerful is not having seen how they got to the point where you then meet them.
Yes.
You know? And by the way, that's not to say, like, there haven't been interesting prequels, but I think one of the tools of storytelling is not telling.
Yes.
And letting the audience run with that or imagine how they got there. I think it's also one of the reasons, like, I do what I do, is the stuff when I was a teenager that stuck with me, maybe like even bumped for me on its first viewing. Like, I don't think I got Diva or Subway the first time I watched them, but I went back and I watched them tons of times again. because I wanted to understand them. And we're not great these days at doing that.
As the writer and director of this one, you're not writing for another director. And
no, so what's exactly. That like? Well, first of all, you can beat up on the writer probably more than you would if it was a different person. You can definitely be mean. And I think you actually have to learn to be. Like, one of the things that people, particularly actors, always expect when you're a writer-director, and even more so when you're a first-time writer-director, is that you're going to be like, oh no, say that comma, say that, you know. And I'm not really interested in that. I also, it helps that I have the worst memory of any human being in the world. Like, Brian Tyree Henry and Sterling K. Brown, who play the bank-robbing pair of siblings in the movie. I was with them last night, and they were doing this thing they do where they just throw lines backwards and forwards at each other. Not only can I not do that about other movies, I don't remember them from my own film. Like, yeah. To the degree that my producer kept a file of lines that I cut from different drafts of the movie, and he would show me them sometimes, and I'd be like, that one's good.
Who wrote that?
Yeah. So I think, you know, I think one of the things you have to do is be ruthless with yourself as a writer. And then when you get in the edit, you have to be ruthless with yourself as a director, you know. And that's, it's something that, it's actually, it came to me weirdly easily. Like, I kept waiting for the bump where I would start being defensive. But honestly, the team around me in the edit would be like, whoa, no, you can't do that. I'm like, yeah, we can. Yeah, we can cut that. Yeah, we can lose that line.
Well, I imagine working with someone like Shane Black, you like learn to be tough on writing too.
That's definitely true. Though actually the interesting thing about Shane and the reason that his movies have that amazing kind of shaggy dog quality, you know, is that if Shane falls in love with a line, he's going to keep it in. Like it'll be even the reason for a scene. And that's good to remember as well, because it's good to remember that the reason for a scene doesn't have to be like, oh, because it's pushing plot on from A to B. I don't care about plot. Honestly, I'm like, for a person like whose secret living is like script doctoring and edit doctoring, I walk out of almost every film I ever go to and I cannot describe to you the plot. And it's because it's not what the snake brain part of me is responding to. I'm responding to characters and maybe their stories, but not like the plot.
Right.
And I respond to like images or just scenes or, you know, moments. I think it's really important to remember that that's one of the ways we take in films, you know?
I read that it was an interesting experience working with Shane on Iron Man when he came on.
Well, it was brilliant. I mean, like, yeah, there's a notorious beginning to our relationship, which is, I always think that like the Iron Man experience was a bit like a classic 80s Shane Black movie for me, in that like the grizzled veteran was forced to work by the commissioner with the kind of bright-eyed newbie. But across the course of their adventure together, they both learned to respect each other and then became a team by the end.
At first he's like, I work alone.
Yeah, no, oh, by the way. I mean, literally, except he would be like this, I work alone, because Shane has the lowest voice you've ever heard. But no, I mean, Kevin Feige brought me on, and then a week later brought Shane Black on to ostensibly to write. And Shane clearly and rightfully went to Kevin, I mean, you know, I have something of a reputation as a writer, right? Kevin was like, well, I think you guys should try and work together. And Shane was not down. But we did a week together in his giant mansion in LA. And over the course of that week, we went from something that was stilted but respectful to the end of the week when it was one of the best, probably one of the best days of my working life, actually, which is we're in a meeting at Marvel and I'm going back to London. I still lived in England at the time. I was like going back to London the next day and I was like, man, out of sight, out of mind, you know, like I'm going to be done on this thing. Shane stopped the meeting at one point and he just went,
I'd like you to know that over the course of this week, I have found Drew to be both an excellent gentleman and a writer of great spirit. So I will be happy to co-write the movie with him. And like, it was just amazing. I was like, okay, this is good. And I eventually, because of that, I then moved to Los Angeles and worked ridiculously closely with him, i.e. 14 hours a day in his house.
Wow.
Well, because Shane has this theory, and I love it, and it's something that I applied to Hotel Artemis, which is the act of making a movie kind of makes, like, kind of the act of it takes the flavor out. It's very easy to end up with a blander end product. So what you have to do is you have to put as many complementary, strong flavors in the pot at the beginning, and that way you get something unique and you get something flavorful at the end. And I think he's totally right. And sometimes that, again, doesn't really happen much these days. It's one of the reasons that actually one of the biggest influences on Hotel Artemis, oddly, is Asian cinema, is Korean cinema of the last 10 years. Because I love the way that, you know, that Korean cinema, like, in the course of one scene, will be like high drama, really broad comedy, ultra violence, and then like super sincere emotion. And I love that there's no fear of doing that. And yeah, I don't know. I think there's an interesting thing with Korean cinema, and I think it may, its influence on our generation of kind of Western filmmakers may be kind of what like the baby boomers had with Kurosawa and stuff. I think like it's so different to what we've had in the last 10 or 20 years that it's now coming through, like in color and all of that stuff.
Well, it's all accessible now too.
Yeah, no, well, and that's absolutely right. Yeah, exactly. But I think even if you look at like Jordan's Skull Island or Taika's Ragnarok, I think the fact that we're all embracing color and moving away from desaturated stuff and handheld, I think Asian cinema has an influence on that.
Really?
Yeah, I do. I really do. And I mean, it's one of the reasons I got incredibly lucky in that the cinematographer for Hotel Artemis is Chung Hoon Chung, who was the, you know, was the lenser of the original Old Boy.
You can see that in there.
Oh yeah, for sure. Which is also weird when, like, because I have a corridor fight scene, and it's like, well, guess I'm not shooting this from the side. like, not going up against that one. But yeah, and I mean, and that came about because I was talking to a whole bunch of brilliant American cinematographers, and I realized that a third of the, like, the lookbook that I was showing them was shot by Chung, and I was like, I mean, maybe I should just talk to Chung, like, and he's, I mean, I would make every movie with him. I just adore him.
Was he hard to get a hold of?
No, that's the thing. Like, he actively wanted to do more American movies, but there is an innate racism against non-American cinematographers and other crew members. And look, I get what it's based on, particularly as a first-time director. There were people, there were producers who were worried that if English isn't the first language with one of the people that you're working with, and communication is already a thing that, you know, I'll be learning as a first-time director, then maybe that's insurmountable. But first of all, as Chung said, like, he may not be able to discuss politics, but he does speak the language of cinema. And he truly does. Like, there wasn't a second where I didn't understand him, or anyone on the crew didn't understand him. But it's also, you know, like, in the 70s, most American directors worked with Italian cinematographers who point blank refused to speak a word of English. we've all read the Apocalypse Now stuff where, like, the Italian camera crew would just fly in at giant expense, like, specific pastas from, like, one village. And Chung didn't do any of that.
No pasta?
No. There was no. I mean, to be fair, we're in LA, so if he wanted for Korean barbecue, it really wasn't a tough run. He's amazing, and like, he's all over that movie as well.
Yeah, his mark is definitely all over it.
Yeah.
So when you shot it, was it on just one soundstage because you're all in one place?
I mean, honestly, it's, you know, we had 33 days to shoot. Which means that some of the actors that you see in the movie were literally there for 2 days or 3 days. Like, there was never a moment when the whole of the cast was there. There's never been a moment where the whole cast has been together. There may never be, except in the movie itself, which is a super weird concept. Particularly because it's so enclosed and it happens on one night.
It's like Raymond Burr in the Godzilla recut.
Exactly that. Exactly that. So we built a bit of the interior, but we could only afford to build like one corridor and two bedrooms and then one other room that got swapped around for a bunch of other things, which is terrifying.
It's like my apartment.
Oh, there we go. Once every 3 days do you change the wallpaper? Because that's exactly what I had to do. And that's terrifying because it means you can't go back. Like, that, when you can literally, there's nothing worse than the sound while you try and eat your lunch of someone chainsawing the set apart. No, just knowing that, like, if you didn't get what you needed in those 3 days, you're never getting it because you're never going to be able to afford reshoots.
Sure.
So we built part of it, and then we made the rest of the hotel out of real downtown LA locations. So the roof is the Roslyn Hotel. And again, I wanted to shoot on the real rooftops of LA because, like, even LA's kind of light pollution is distinctive, and you can't fake it in Vancouver or Atlanta or London. But it was also a weird decision, it turned out, because, like, I fought for it for like 6 months and everyone was like, no, you got to green screen it. I was like, no, we're going to be on the rooftops of LA. This is the movie we're making. It's baking it into the DNA. And then we went on the very first scout to the rooftops, and I walked out and I'd completely forgotten that I'm terrified of heights.
Sure.
And so I had genuinely spent 6 months fighting for a thing that, I mean, honestly, like, and it's funny, Chung comes from a tradition of Korean cinematography where he will literally throw himself from, like, Raid 2 style, from like one truck to another without being on any kind of harness. And he would just like hang off the side of the building. He'd be like, Drew, come look at this. And I mean, I couldn't even watch him do it, let alone get close to the edge. So that was a weird decision on my part.
Anything for the shot.
Yeah, exactly. And we pieced together some other bits. Like, we used the lobby from, do you know about the Hotel Cecil in downtown LA?
Yes, yeah.
It's famously, recently, apparently haunted. That's your bag?
Oh, yeah.
That's your bag.
Yeah.
So you will then know why we decided not to use the roof of the Cecil.
Yeah, good idea. Don't do that.
Yeah, because 2 years ago, there was a dead body found in the water tank. Yeah. And then footage in the elevator of a girl who was either being, like, who was either, and I'm going to use air quotes that no one can see, possessed.
Sure.
Or being chased by some kind of phantom that we never see on the video. But it's really,
really
weird.
High.
You know, if you had done it in that hotel, though, you might have been one of the first films to have a ghost on screen.
Well, we did shoot the lobby of Hotel Artemis in the lobby of the Cecil. We simply took the executive decision not to shoot the rooftops there as well because, like, it's bad enough I'm scared of the heights. I don't want to be scared of the ghosts as well.
Caitlin just having some sort of, like, exorcism in her new apartment, she could have sent the person over to.
Did you have a legit exorcism?
No. My new apartment coming up, though, is in a Masonic temple. That I just got, so gonna.
By the way, first of all, sounds
that.
Like quite a big apartment for New York. Masonic
you'd be
temple.
Very surprised. There's like 60 apartments in this one giant building.
It's so Ghostbusters. You've seen Ghostbusters, right?
I've seen Ghostbusters.
That's a warning.
I know. Our cat's gonna be the one to warn us. I swear to God, something's gonna happen to him.
They always get it first.
They do. Yeah.
Just be careful of the fridge, is what I would say.
Good tip.
You're taking notes for your Ghostbusters thing.
That was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Yeah, it's, Caitlin was literally just telling me about moving in there and, you know.
That is amazing. And I would say dicey decision.
It's going to be an adventure.
You lived here, though. I mean, you know.
There's no place in New York, I feel like, where someone has not been killed, where something horrible has happened.
No, absolutely. In fact, and I was like coming here, I was on the plane on Monday, and a friend of mine, whose name I will not mention, was like, oh, where are you staying? And I told him the name of the hotel. He's like, oh, man, I really hope you don't stay in any of the rooms that I've stayed in there. I was like, don't say that. That's the most gross thing I've ever heard. I was like, how many rooms have you stayed in? And he was like,
8
in one trip, or
oh god, can you imagine? That would be even worse. I think that moves into some like, oh, you're not talking about what I think you're talking about. You're talking about like moving around rooms and killing people.
Yes.
But yeah, so no, you know, there is, but I mean, the joy of New York is, of course, the spirits that inhabit it.
The compromises we make to live in the city.
Yeah. Though weirdly, where I live in Los Angeles is a place called Los Feliz, which is kind of on the east side. And I was reading a thing the other day that Paul Thomas Anderson refuses to live there or indeed shoot there because he believes it's the most haunted place he's ever been.
Really?
So I'm sharing your risky business by living it up with the spirits of a city.
I live on the Upper East Side, so I just know there's so many people who have died, especially in my part of
town. Yeah. But the great thing is, like, they were rich people, so they're probably not that grumpy.
That's true.
They're
the most grumpy.
Yeah.
Or they're the most grumpy, maybe. Yeah. And vengeful. That you're taking their rightful places.
Taking their closet.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you wrote and directed this movie.
Yeah.
And you're gonna go, you're still a writer, right? Obviously.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what is it like to go back and write something that someone else is gonna direct now that...
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't know yet because I've not started my next screenwriting gig, though I think it's happening. I just cannot say what it is.
Sure.
But honestly, I'm kind of excited because there's nothing that makes you want to like relinquish responsibility and just write a massive movie like having the entire responsibility of directing an indie movie.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds weirdly like a holiday to me compared with the last 2 years. Now, I'm sure those two things will end up like feeding back to each other and that I'll go do a gig and I'll, you know, at some point I'll be like, oh, I wish I was telling this as a director. Honestly, like what I'm kind of hoping to do is keep both of those things open. I mean, I've been a little spoiled now creatively by doing Hotel Artemis, which for good or for bad is literally all me, right? And it's very hard to think about directing a movie now where that wouldn't be the case.
Yeah, seriously. Great cast, great concept.
Yeah, great. And like I say, like a switchy tone that allows me to put a whole bunch of the things I love in a film. But then I also love, but I had to make it for a price, you know, and it was unbelievably tough to do that. And so there's a part of me that also is excited to get back to someone else's shared playset, you know, the big train set that you get to work with. So that's what I'm hoping. And look, maybe someday those two, you know, we cross the streams.
Yeah.
Oh my God, was that the Masonics?
They're following her.
Oh my, they're already here.
Yeah.
You know, maybe one day those two things will cross. But I actually, like, at the moment, I'm really happy if I can, you know, if I can do both, if I'm allowed to do both, we'll see.
It's funny when people say that when I'm allowed to do it, like you said, hard to have any control of your career.
You don't have any control. I mean, like, it was, you know, it's funny. Like, 2 months ago, I was, you know, because, bear in mind, I haven't been paid for 2 years because I've been making an indie movie. So,
that's not lucrative?
Oddly, no.
change my career plan.
Strangely enough, near future movies about 68-year-old women are not the ones that you make the check for.
Oh.
But I know, I'm so sorry to burst
even
your bubble.
Even when you pack Sterling K. Brown and Jeff Goldblum in.
Even when you do that.
Put all my spec scripts about old women back in the drawer.
I'm sure that's only one of the drawers that you have. I mean, the old woman drawer.
You've just
gone all in on old women.
Yeah.
We're going to have to burn those later.
I know a really good actress that you should speak to.
I don't think I can top it. I don't think I can top yours.
I'm sure that's not true. But no, you don't control anything. And like, you know, when I came back in, I kind of tentatively flipped the sign in the window that was like, open for screenwriter business, like 2 months ago. You don't know if you've been forgotten or there's just like brilliant younger people than you, you know, like you just don't know. And I got lucky or whatever, you know, and there's some really interesting stuff out there. But also studios are making less movies. You know, there's a whole, you know, glut even of golden age TV, but I think it's tougher and tougher for that to cut through now.
There's so much streaming.
Yeah, there's so much streaming. And I feel like the algorithm The algorithm can fuck you really quickly.
The almighty algorithm.
Yeah, exactly. All of our algorithms.
Especially when someone who you're friends with, but you can't, you're not sure who it is, uses your Netflix.
I literally have this at the moment. Yeah. I have this happening at the moment. Again, it's like a Masonic ghost of Netflix. Like,
keep coming back.
The one that's killed me on is Mr. Robot, the last season of Mr. Robot, because I was shooting the movie while it was on, so I'm like playing catch up. But, you know, there's an element to Mr. Robot of, again, as a person who truly doesn't follow plot, like is in it for the moment, there's a world where I can like skip an episode of Mr. Robot and be like, is it just me being dumb? Or yeah. I was like, how did I get to episode 8?
Yes.
And it turned out I'd only got to episode 2.
It happens a lot. Or like the whole algorithm screws up. I've had friends who use my Netflix and my Hulu, and there's just so many suggested shows that I'm like almost insulted. Like whatever combination of what I watch and they watch,
yeah,
produces
the worst
suggestions.
Has created some weird Frankenstein viewer.
Yeah,
yeah, no, that is definitely a problem as well.
Yeah, I guess maybe they like it that way. That way, people don't share.
Yeah, it's a funny thing as well because like, if the equivalent of it used to be like VHSs in your video store, like. The funny thing about it was secretly an algorithm, a personal algorithm. Like, you would see RoboCop next to Repo Man, and as a 14-year-old, I'd just be like, okay, well, I mean, like, if they're next to each other, then I guess they're probably both good, and they both were. But what you forgot is there was a human being that was, like, curating where those things went.
Instead of a robot.
Instead of an almighty robot. And I kind of miss the human touch. I miss it inside films, and I miss it kind of about films as well.
Well, and you say that you focus so much on character when you're building all of these people. We were talking about, you know, Jodie Foster's character, her accent is so specific. Her little shuffle is just so...
People love the shuffle.
I was laughing at it. And, you know, it was so good.
It took me a couple of takes to get used to it. Her age was in the script, and the fact that she self-medicates with anything available to her is in the script. And Jodie and I talked for weeks and months about the character, but you don't see those little physical things until the first time she's on set. And actually, weirdly, you'll do the makeup tests in advance. So I knew what she was going to look like, but I'd never seen her move. And you know, we do the wake up scene, and her waddle is much more pronounced. And I was like, God, is this going to be too much? And so she and I spoke, and she was like, just so you know, and I'm telling you this as a 54-year-old woman, you are in weird shape when you wake up as you get older. Like, and it will shake off as the day goes on. And I was like, Jesus. And that's what's brilliant about Jodie is she has genuinely thought inside every single second of the character in every moment. And people ask, is that not intimidating? And of course, you could choose to be intimidated by it, but actually, it's also pretty good to just think of it as an amazing resource in your first movie and just like be like, oh, that she thought of that. Okay, I didn't get to that. Like, we should go with it.
Well, it has to be kind of gratifying to have someone put that much thought into this character that you've developed.
You know what? That's totally true. And that's also a thing that people don't really acknowledge is particularly when you're a writer director as well, and I've not really had the movie's not out yet, but I've seen it with audiences and it's playing gangbusters and that's brilliant. But there's this 30,000 foot view, which I've had a couple of times where it's like, oh, this is like an act of alchemy. It's almost like art is, and this is a weird grandiose statement, but I'll say it anyway. Like, art is like magic. It's like you take something that's not there and you conjure it into existence. That's an amazing thing that maybe we don't appreciate as much as we could. I've gone too far now.
No, I'm not. No. That's very true.
That's very true.
What about her accent? Was that all her?
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, like we talked about it.
Sure.
So the interesting thing is her voice, like her dialogue voice, is very influenced. There's a whole thing in the movie of kind of like the last 100 years of LA, you know, and a kind of 1920s meets 2020s vibe. And so there's a kind of like golden era Hollywood rat-a-tat-tat to the way that she speaks. There's almost a kind of Billy Wilder kind of thing.
Sure.
And that's one of the things that she dug. She was like, oh, I come at this like Barbara Stanwyck. And actually one of the other things she did was Dustin Hoffman. So she, and I'd never spotted this before, it's a brilliant observation. Hoffman is really good at characters who, it's very, very, very difficult for actors to sell dialogue that is them speaking to themselves. It's like every actor's worst thing. But Hoffman does it really well. Like he's his own audience. His characters often like tell themselves jokes to make themselves laugh. And I think Jodie tapped into that. And so I think some of the accent came from a very kind of ratzo place as well. And I think that's why she gravitated to a little bit of New York in there too.
I liked, and like having Jeff Goldblum on set must've been real fun.
Yeah. Well, it's basically like having Sinatra on set. It's amazing. And it's no coincidence that Jeff's jazz and his renaissance as an actor have kind of gone hand in hand, because I think the two are feeding into each other. I think like he kind of acts as a jazz musician, and he's not like other actors. You can see him like swirling words round in his mouth before he says them. And he's very considered about it as well, but then he'll just like find his own thing. And because of that, like you need to give him really esoteric direction. Well, you cannot, but like one of the things I found most effective was giving him like idiosyncratic ways to try and find a change to the line. So for example, like, one of the bits where his character has to go really dark, and Jeff is actually one of the reasons I think he doesn't play dark characters as much anymore, is because he's in such a great place. Like he's very happy. So I needed to get him there, and like I tried a couple of things, and then I was like, okay, you know those kind of like specific, that kind of Celtic Irish drunk that's like the happiest person in the bar for four drinks, and then they have that fifth one, and then they just turn 180 and their voice changes and the timbre changes and like it taps their darkness. And Jeff does this thing with his finger, which again you can't see, but which is a little bit like a pecking bird. And I actually genuinely think he's thinking about it like a musician. He's like tapping out the timbre of what he's gonna do, and he's like, good, let's do that. And then he literally, like the take that's in the movie is the one from that.
Oh, wow.
That's great.
And I used like four lines from the tape because it was just like, boom, he just did it straight through.
Yeah, Caitlin says she imagines he's a very good hugger, too.
He's a wonderful hugger.
It's my dream.
There's a text on my phone. Oh, I've switched off my phone. There's literally, I texted him last weekend because he couldn't be at the premiere for Hotel Artemis because he was recording his first jazz album at the Capitol building. Which, by the way, I was like, do I go to my premiere or do I go to the recording of my
Jeff's jazz album? Do I go watch Creep on him?
Yeah. He invited me. I was like, Jeff, I can't go, Jeff. I've just made my first movie and I've got to promote it. But like, I've just got the best text from him, which is just like, I love you. And I'm like, oh, I've got a text from Goldblum that says, I love you.
Yeah.
I'm just going to keep that. Yeah, I may not ever text him back and just make it the end of the chain.
It's one to the archives right there.
Exactly.
Yeah,
no, he's amazing. He's amazing to have around. The interesting thing about Jeff is he's everything you would hope he would be. And he is that all the way through.
I think Jordan was wondering, what does Jeff Goldblum smell like?
Do you know what? He smells amazing. Sure. He's absolutely, he's like platinum and sandalwood. He is like, and he glides. Like, it's amazing. He's an extraordinary bloke.
He's like real bad in the movie, like a bad guy in the movie, but so
don't say he's really bad.
No, he's great. He's great.
He's fantastic.
When does Hotel Artemis hit theaters?
June 8th, next Friday. This Friday, depending on when this podcast goes out. And it's one of those things. It's like, we are a small movie coming out in the terrifying wilds of blockbuster country. And we're not a sequel, and we're not based on a property, and we're not a reboot. And, you know, but I think what we have got is personality. And, you know, and I hope and I think that we're a movie that people can really fall in love with. So I hope they'll go to it.
I mean, Jeff Goldblum, Jodie Foster.
Worth the ticket.
Yeah.
Brian Tyree Henry, I'll do the list. Yeah, Jenny Slate, Charlie Day, uh-huh. knocking out the park. Dave Bautista, of course.
He's so big.
Yeah, I know.
He's so big.
Zachary Quinto. Yes. I mean, to be fair, he's next to Jodie Foster, who is the smallest person you've ever met. So, and that's a purposeful juxtaposition.
Sure.
But yeah. No, it's, you know, it's an amazing cast. And, you know, I hope people dig it.
Yes, go see it, everybody. Thanks so much for being here, Jim.
Absolutely. Thank, awesome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Bye. Good ending.